Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to New Books and Music, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Kristen Turner, and today we'll be talking about all things soul with Emily J. Lordy, author of The Meaning of Soul, Black Music and Resilience Since the 1960s, from Duke University Press. Soul is one of those concepts that is often evoked, but rarely satisfactorily defined. In her book, Lordy takes on the challenge of explaining soul through a book that zooms in and out between sweeping ideas about suffering and resilience in Black culture and fine-grained close readings of individual performances by soul musicians. She focuses on artists that are some of the most recognizable Black singers in the United States, such as Aretha Franklin, Nina Simone, and James Brown, but spends a lot of time with more obscure figures as well, including Donny Hathaway and Minnie Riperton. She ends the book with a powerful contemplation of how these ideas, born in the political and social tumult of the late 1960s, still resonate with some of today's most popular women singers. Thank you so much for joining me today, Emily.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you are in the English department at Vanderbilt University, but this is very much a book about music. How did you come to this topic?
Well, I started thinking about music and literature in conjunction with one another as a graduate student, actually. I studied at Columbia University, where I was in the English department, but I was sort of under the tutelage of several scholars, including Robert G. O'Mealy, Farrah Jasmine Griffin, Brent Hayes Edwards, Robin Kelly came through, and various people came through who were really thinking about music, you know, whether from a historian's vantage point, as was the case with Kelly, or from a kind of literary critical perspective, as was the case with the other scholars that I mentioned. And so it was just this like wonderful place and time in which to engage in the kind of interdisciplinary study of both African-American musical forms, as well as their kind of literary counterparts. And so that became that kind of interdisciplinary engagement provided the basis for my dissertation, which became my first book, which was a comparative analysis of Black women singers and the African-American writers who invoke them. So that particular book, Black Resonance, which came out in 2013, that paired people like Richard Wright and Bessie Smith, the writer Gail Jones and Billie Holiday. And then the last chapter looked at Aretha Franklin and Nikki Giovanni. And it was in studying those particular artists in conjunction with each other and also in relationship to the wider network of Black arts and Black power artists and activists of the late 60s and 70s. I was trying to write both Giovanni and Franklin into a narrative alongside those political, social, and cultural actors. It was in doing that work that I realized that that could be its own book, you know, that looking at soul artists like Franklin and the writers who I think tell us as much as anybody about what they were doing, how they sounded, and the kind of broader cultural import of their musical advances. That was kind of the birthplace or the origin of what became the Soul Book, which was actually going to be an interdisciplinary study like the first one. I was going to think about, what soul literature might be. But as I started delving into the music, I kind of realized that there was so much just to say about that. And frankly, that it was just more manageable, to look at the musicians kind of in their own right. So that's what I really kind of ended up doing. And the last thing that I'll say about it is I was motivated to do it not only because I was personally invested, in this music and in this kind of cultural political moment, but because there was really a dearth of scholarship on artists, even like Aretha Franklin, which might seem surprising, but when I was starting out, and I think this is still the case, researching Franklin, this would have been, around 2008, 2009, I was really surprised to find how little serious scholarly attention her music had really gotten at that point. And so, I sought to fill a gap with this book, that others have since, in the decade or so since, others have of course, come in to help fill as well. But that was another kind of impetus for this project.
So, of course, that brings up the question in the answer that you gave here about how you came to the book. But also, you talk about this book is about, and according to the title, is about the meaning of soul. So why don't we start there? What is the meaning of soul?
The meaning of soul, as I discovered, the more that I was reading accounts in the Black and White press in the late 1960s in particular, what I found was not so much an attempt to define soul on the part of the various writers and musicians associated with that concept, so much as a particular logic that I felt was inhering in the way that people talked about soul. So the way that people would talk about it would be to say, Black people have been through a series of kind of historical trials and have through that actually earned a kind of badge of survivorship that's called soul, right? So whatever else people wanted to say about soul, it was connected to historical and present suffering and struggles of Black people as a group. But of course, to have soul was a good thing, right? Nobody wanted to have suffered in this way, but it was a rhetorical and kind of almost philosophical way of turning Black disadvantage to spectacular advantage and saying to white America, you might love this music, but you can't actually claim to have soul because you simply haven't been through the kinds of things that Black people have been through together. And so the utility of this concept was really as that it allowed Black people to organize themselves around this concept of shared collective resilience, and to create a different kind of narrative of what they had come through. And what it meant to have come through that together, what it yielded, right, in the form of this beautiful kind of sense of survivorship and possibility that was called soul. So it was almost a kind of existential claim that helped rally Black people, helped bring them together, and that was manifested perhaps most dramatically in the music called Soul, which, as I explain, was composed of various techniques through which Black artists perform this sense of resilient survivorship on a national stage.
One of the things that I appreciated about the introduction to your book is that you have pointed out that the way we remember soul now is flawed, and that part of what you're doing is trying to reclaim what soul really was at the time. Can you talk a little bit about that difference between the historical memory of soul and what you found when you were really went back and looked at it closely?
Sure. I think that there are a few different ways that people have tended to remember soul and, kind of depending on where you're coming from and who you are. But I will say that first and foremost, I was sort of taking issue with popular representations of soul that we get in various biopics and even documentaries about soul artists. And so one thing that I mention in the book, for example, is the film Ray about Ray Charles, which I actually really like, but which does frame his music as a kind of mystical product of childhood trauma, namely the loss of his mother. And that's a very common trope. We see this especially in films about soul women, such as Nina Simone, right? Where it's like your own kind of personal biographical suffering leads you to somehow, you know, create this incredible art. And that kind of narrative, one thing that it does is it devalues the conscious, deliberate, strategic artistry of these soul figures, right? It really devalues the way in which Ray Charles was practicing, right? That he actually had to like develop. People might have been prodigies, you know, and Ray Charles certainly was, as was Nina Simone, as was Aretha, as was Donny Hathaway, as were, you know, several of the people who went on to become, you know, incredible icons of this music. But as we know, you know, prodigious talent without practice really doesn't get you very far. So I wanted to talk about the actual material labor that went into creating soul music as a kind of counter narrative to some of these more popular, you know, Hollywood and other kinds of productions. I also wanted to spotlight women, Black women, who are often and still written out of, you know, histories of the music, documentaries, and so forth. And, you know, from another perspective, finally, I'll just say that there was another kind of more academic critical discourse that I was trying to create a counter narrative to, that in some ways the book is like an explicit polemic against, which is the discourse of post-soul theory. And that's something that arises in the late 2000s, most clearly in the late 2000s, as an articulation of this concept that says that the work created by Black artists born after 1963, so in a post-soul moment, is more kind of inclusive, radical, and vibrant than that created during the soul era itself. So even though post-soul theory doesn't tend to actually define what soul is, it nonetheless implicitly posits soul as a kind of foil, right, as this, you know, sort of nebulous but nefarious, you know, heterosexist, patriarchal, very limiting kind of formation that later post-soul artists get to free themselves from or need to overcome in some way. And so when I saw, you know, this kind of development of post-soul theory, and I should say that there are some people who talk about post-soul in much more complicated and interesting ways, but I think that the general tendency has been to draw this line between, on the one hand, work created during Black arts and Black power, which, you know, people talk about as the soul kind of, formation that is very restrictive, and it's about, you know, kind of Black nationalist solidarity, and there's only one particular way to be Black, and it's, you know, very limiting and essentialist and all these bad things on the one hand. And then there's what happens like in this post-soul moment, right, a post-revolutionary moment where everybody's free to, you know, kind of be themselves, and there's no, you know, thing that you have to do. It's just your work is Black because you are, and that kind of thing. But I just wanted to say, I think that we see all of that kind of freedom in the soul era itself. But if we don't actually ask again, return to that question of what soul is, then we're not really going to see that.
Well, you brought up a lot of rich areas of your book in that answer that I'd like to sort of follow up on. So maybe we can start with just, what do you think is at stake when a Black musician is making music, maybe specifically soul music, but maybe, you know, music in general?
Do you mean, what is at stake when any
When Aretha Franklin, I should make it more specific, that'll make it more a logical question, I guess. When Aretha Franklin goes into the studio to make music in the late 60s, with all that's going on, you know, what's at stake for her? What is she needing to respond to, and how are people going to respond to her?
Well, by the late 1960s, I mean, Aretha's an interesting case because she had, you know, been performing basically for her entire life. You know, she was the kind of like the golden child of the very famous Reverend C.L. Franklin, minister in Detroit, who was a quite famous preacher in his own right, and kind of, I wouldn't say groomed, but certainly nurtured the young Aretha, you know, into the musical profession, you know. So she would tour the gospel circuit with people like Mahalia Jackson, and she had started recording, you know, quite young and doing jazz albums and different kinds of things, and, you know, really trying to make her name as an artist. And so by the late 1960s, when she finally starts to hit, you know, she signs to Atlantic Records, which is a big moment for her. And, you know, as we often see in the gender politics of these representations, her real emergence is often falsely or mistakenly credited to people like Jerry Wexler, you know, who's the head of Atlantic Records at the time. Like, oh, so he finally knew what to do with Aretha is the kind of common refrain. But she's figuring out what to do herself. You know, and one thing that she does is start to play piano, for instance, on her own recordings. And that allows her not only to really find claim that seat of power as a pianist, but to direct the band and to create, you know, arrangements, you know, around herself and what she's doing. So she's taking control. She's, you know, been ready to be a star for many years. She tells a reporter in the late 60s that she feels like she's 25 going on 50. You know, she's an old soul. And so by the late 1960s, she's trying to make her name. You know, she's trying to prove that she can make it kind of outside of the church. And with this very kind of new form of blues-based R&B that she is really kind of innovating through her work at Muscle Shoals and in general.
Just to keep on Aretha for a few more minutes, one of the real gifts of the book is that you have some very precise and interesting analyses of a lot of different performances throughout the book. And one of them that really caught my eye was your analysis of Amazing Grace, on her cover of Amazing Grace specifically. And you talked about it as an example of erotic sociality, which I found quite provocative, and I'd love for you to talk a little bit more about how you hear that piece.
Sure. Excuse me. So yeah, Aretha, you know, records Amazing Grace at a church in Watts in Los Angeles in, I think it's 1971. And it's sort of a homecoming for her, you know, as somebody who had, you know, had come up through the church as her original kind of training ground as a singer, and had kind of quote unquote crossed over into a more kind of pop market, you know, been marketed as a soul artist and had been crowned the queen of soul by then. So for her to come back to church was really an interesting moment. And when she sings Amazing Grace, you know, you can kind of hear her bringing all the kind of sexual energy that had informed her more secular musical productions, songs like Dr. Feelgood, most obviously. But she's bringing that, you know, back into a gospel idiom. And in fact, I would say in that way, tapping into the sexual ecstatic fervor that people like E. Patrick Johnson tell us is part of Black religious worship in the first place, right? So it's not exactly that she's importing something that wasn't there. She's simply highlighting, I think, the very kind of sexual dimensions, the erotic sociality that one finds within a lot of Black musical traditions themselves. And so in Amazing Grace in particular, where I hear that is, for example, in the slow build. You know, she really kind of takes her time in dramatically building the song up to its melodic climax on the word grace, which is, of course, very fitting, right? Because that's the climax of the song. And she kind of takes it back down and she brings it back up. And there are these peaks and valleys, you know, throughout her rendition of the song that I think are creating a kind of a delay, a suspense that is to me kind of fundamentally erotic. So you're kind of waiting for her to reach the high note that you know she's going to get to, right? She's making you wait for it and making you wait for it to sort of come back, you know, when she's going to sing it again. And the way that she involves everybody in that kind of anticipatory erotic energy is what makes it, you know, such a collective experience.
So to stay with Aretha and the church for just a little bit longer, she is, like so many other soul singers, really comes out of the church. That's her first musical experience, and you see that in so many different soul musicians as well. But also your idea of what the soul means seems to me to have a lot of resonance with Christian belief as well, since, you know, the idea that suffering can be overcome, and that there can be meaning in the experience of suffering is very central to Christian theology as well. Can you talk a little bit about how you see the kind of triangle between the the secular side of the music, Christian tradition, and you know, musical and theological, and then also the it's sort of the political moment that soul is being made in, how all of that kind of works together.
Sure. So, you know, I guess I should first say soul is itself is clearly a theological concept, right? The idea of having a soul is already sort of aligning oneself with a divine energy or a force that is greater than oneself. And so it has particular resonance in religious contexts. And yet what happens in my mind in the soul era is that these very long-standing Judeo-Christian beliefs in the redemptive value of suffering become translated into a more secular context. So whereas in Christian tradition, the concept might be that, you know, the last shall be first in this, you know, afterlife, right? That your reward for earthly suffering and devotion and faith is achieved in a world beyond this one. What soul, the secularization of soul discourse does in the late 1960s is to say, suffering does have value, it does have payoff, but that reward is here, right? It's an earthly reward, and it comes in the form of a kind of sense of communal belonging to other, particularly with other Black people who have experienced similar issues, right? And also in the form of a kind of, in musical terms, virtuosic performative abilities, right? And so one way to understand that, the clearest, I think, illustration of that would be to point to somebody like James Brown, who says, you know, who literally markets himself as the hardest working man in show business, right? Now, why is it a good thing to be the hardest working man in show business, right? You might say, oh, that must be frustrating for you, or, you know, how sad that you have to work that hard. But the soul, the logic of soul is precisely to say, no, because I work so hard, I become the best, right? It is precisely through hard work, through labor, through struggle and suffering and strain, that I have achieved the capacity to perform in a way that outshines anyone else, right? That is the source of the star time, star power that James Brown represented. And so that's kind of what soul is about. It's about that turn. And I should say that we hear that turn in Aretha's rendition of Amazing Grace, which for all of its social, sexual energy is also, in my hearing, a call to liberation. It's about collective striving toward this home, again, that I hear not only as this, you know, otherworldly kind of home, but a home right here, you know, perhaps within the music, but as representing the possibility of a home on earth, you know, that would, or a place that would feel more like a home, you know, for Black people, you know, in the United States itself. And the reason why I say that is because she changes the lyrics as she sings the song. And she says not only that Grace will lead me home, which is the, you know, the lyric of the original, but she sings that Grace is going to lead me and my people right on home. So it's this collective endeavor. And finally, you know, the collectivity of it is heard in the very structure of the call and response that you hear in that performance, where she says, I know that same old Grace is going to lead me and my people right on. And there becomes a kind of a bouncing back and forth between her own right on and that of the choir. They start saying right on, right on. And that, I mean, you can almost, it's almost like the musical equivalent of like the raised Black power fist, right? It sounds like they could be giving each other, like, we're going to do this thing, you know, together. And so that's a beautiful example of the way that the secular and the sacred and the sexual and the social can all coexist together in this extraordinary musical performance.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and
and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
The section that you refer to as part of your answer about John, about Brown and about how he was the hardest working man in music and so forth. I really loved that section. But one of the things that I thought about was as I got to the end of the book and you started talking about more recent music, you talked about Beyoncé. And I really think we might put Beyoncé in that same sort of category of someone who's so physically virtuosic on stage and is also clearly working really hard. And this came out after your book, but the whole Homecoming show and the Netflix documentary about that really talks about how much work she's doing, right? As a performer, as a woman getting over pregnancy, or childbirth, as a producer and sort of thing. Can you maybe talk a little bit about your view of someone like Beyoncé within the paradigm you've constructed in the book?
Sure. And I do talk about this at more length. I'll just refer listeners who might be interested to an article called Surviving the Hustle, I think the subtitle of which is Beyoncé's Performance of Work. But this has been important to her sort of self-fashioning for many years, is to precisely, as you say, underline the hard work that makes possible her own star power. And I do see her as working, you know, in a tradition of a James Brown, in a tradition of it, Nina Simone, a singer who she explicitly references both visually as well as sonically on her Lemonade visual album. So I see her as in that way, again, resisting the myth of a kind of Black female natural genius, you know, somebody who just, and this is the myth that has dogged Black performers from, you know, since slavery, right? This idea of like the natural, the primitive person who just, you know, does everything kind of with exceptional rhythm, right? And other kinds of musical skill. So she's working against that very consciously and saying like, no, like this does take work. It takes craft. It takes artistry. But the argument that I make about her relationship to the soul tradition specifically is to say that Beyoncé, I think, kind of over the course of her career is a little bit, She changes, I think, the meaning of that hard work, because the meaning of that hard work itself changes in a neoliberal, sort of post-revolutionary neoliberal context in which, you know, hard work becomes now the site of the kind of enterprising individual on his or her hustle who is going to make it, you know, based on their own, you know, kind of wherewithal, right? And if they fail, it's their own fault, right? That is the logic of neoliberalism that says, like, listen, like if you couldn't figure out how to cut it in this economy, then that was your problem. What I'm saying is that one's focus on one's own hard work becomes potentially problematic in that kind of discursive structure. And so what I see Beyoncé is doing just quickly is, you know, with her 2013 album, which is self-titled Beyoncé, capital letters, I see her as kind of revising that traditional focus on her own hard work and, you know, saying like, what have I sacrificed to kind of work this, you know, to gain you know, the kind of capital and status that I have. And musically, as well as visually, she's kind of pulling back from her own perfectionistic star image there. I think she does the same thing on Lemonade, which becomes more and more interested in distributing, I would say, her own star power to other women, for example, in a song like Get Information. So those are my thoughts about Beyoncé in relationship to the kind of hard work ethos that Soul, I think, inaugurates.
I One of the other things that's interesting about the book and sort of circles around to your discussion of Amazing Grace is that it's unusually, at least in my mind, dependent upon covers as many of your main examples. And it's, of course, not that other writers don't talk about covers, but it really struck me you have a whole chapter on covers and there are other covers that you use as examples throughout the book. Why did you find covers to be so such a productive place for your conversation?
Well, the soul cover is useful because it draws our attention to the artist as performer. It shows that artistry, in other words, resides not only in authorship and in composition, but in the act of performing a song that somebody else has written. So, you know, that in some ways is what is at stake in my decision to begin the book with a reading of Gladys Knight and the Pips, I Gotta Use My Imagination. That song was not written by them, you know, but the way that Gladys Knight performs song lyrics that were written by somebody else, you know, that is where the magic of the song happens. Or at least there's as much magic there, you know, in the way that she puts the lyric over, we might say, in the way that the Pips, you know, support her and put it over themselves. As much magic in that as there was, you know, in the people who kind of composed and wrote the lyrics to the song in the first place. You know, this is something that Zora Neale Hurston teaches us, right? In the 1920s, you know, where she talks about the fact that what we really mean by creativity is an original, and this is a paraphrase, it's an original, making original creative use of familiar materials. She says even Shakespeare didn't, like, you know, develop the whole from whole cloth, you know, the ideas for his plays. He was using traditional stories and telling them in his own way. And that's what Black artists have often done. You know, that has been the kind of locus of Black creativity, is to say, look at what I've made of this thing that pre-existed me, but that would never have taken this shape had I not come along. This is the blues, right? I mean, everybody sings the same blues songs, but how are you going to sing it, right? It's about how you insert your own unique voice into this tradition, the same thing with the jazz standard. And so for soul artists, you know, that just becomes that their form of not only covering, not only singing songs composed by others, as was the case with Gladys Knight and the Pips, but covering songs that have been recorded by others and have been big hits, you know, in some cases by other artists. This becomes a way of them, you know, really asserting their own signature voices and, you know, saying, like, you can hear who I am precisely because you can compare what I'm doing to what, you know, in, say, in Aretha's, you know, in the case of Aretha's cover of Respect, you can compare what I'm doing to what Otis Redding did, you know, with Donny Hathaway. You can compare what I'm doing with a beautiful song like A Song for You to what Leon Russell did. And so, you know, I talk about covers as, again, just a way of artists sort of announcing their own signature voices. And in some ways, that is a competitive gesture. You know, it's about outdoing the original. And I think that there's an interesting racial politics to that, especially if the original, you know, has been a hit by white, you know, with or through the, you know, recordings of white artists. And then sometimes I also want to say it's not necessarily, you know, an agonistic struggle for power. Sometimes you're covering a song because you love the song. There's a group called Rotary Connection, which Minnie Riperton, one of my artists in the book, and who's Grace is the cover of the book, that she sings with the band Rotary Connection. And they did a beautiful, like, very interesting, sensual cover of Respect in the years after Aretha Franklin had actually kind of made the song her own. And I asked one of the members of the band why they did that. You know, this Sydney Barnes, who's one of my key interview subjects. And I was kind of like, were you, I don't know, like, how did you feel about doing the song? How did Minnie feel about singing a song that was by then so thoroughly associated with Aretha? And he was just like, it was a great song. We loved the song. We figured it's so good. Like, there's no way we can mess it up. So it's about sort of teasing out all the different relationships that Black artists have to pre-existing material and just showing all the different ways that they take it up and use it to create their own sound.
That cover of Respect is very interesting. I did some listening as I was reading this book, and it's so different. It's almost unrecognizable if what your sonic, I don't know, baseline for Respect is Aretha Franklin's cover. Riverton's version or doesn't sound anything like it, really. So that's interesting that they were like, well, we can't mess it up, so we might as well do something cool with it. You know? It's fascinating. Can you maybe, you have so many interesting analyses in here, but, and we certainly don't have time to go through all of them, but can you maybe think of one that you think is particularly emblematic or one that you would like to talk about just to give our listeners a taste of the kind of information that you're interested in when you do a close reading of a cover?
Sure. Yeah. So one of the covers that I talk about is Nina Simone's cover of the song Life, which was a song drawn from the hit musical Hair. And, you know, when she sings that song, so first of all, it's kind of interesting that she chooses to cover that song. You know, we don't necessarily associate what one might not necessarily associate the Nina Simone of songs like Mississippi Goddam and Four Women with, you know, a Broadway show tune. But it in a sense just displays her kind of very wide-ranging kind of musical imagination and musical taste, you know, that she would take this song that might not sound like a Nina Simone song and take it up into her own voice. One thing that she does as she performs the song is, and I guess in tribute to the sort of multi-textured, no pun intended, roots of Hair itself, which was as a rock musical, right, is already a kind of hybrid form. Nina Simone takes it and she brings her own very syncretic, you know, variegated musical sensibility to her performance of the song. So it's sort of in keeping in that way with the song and the musical from which it is drawn itself. But she, you know, she plays it, you know, I'm interested in this, in particular, the version that I talk about is from, I think it's 1968 live concert. So she's at the piano and she's playing it. And, you know, at a certain point, she kind of, you know, does this fill on the piano that really shows off her classical training, her training in classical music, which she studied throughout, you know, the first part of her life and continued to integrate into her soul and other kinds of musical productions throughout her career. She has these kind of bluesy ad-libs that she does, you know, she says, "Oh Lord, why am I alive anyway?" You know, at some point, because the song is about, I should have said, having nothing but life, right? This is a song people probably know. I got no, you know, money, I got no shoes, I got no, basically like, I have all that I have. What have I got? Why am I alive anyway? What have I got that nobody can take away? And then it's, you know, I've got my body, right? And she goes through kind of catalogs, all the different parts of her body that she still does have. And then concludes by saying, you know, the chorus of the song is, "And I've got life," right? And so, you know, but she tosses off these little moments that seem like they're from the gospel tradition, from the classical tradition, from the blues. And in that way is really, you know, showing that not only is the life that she's laying claim to, you know, one of great richness, but also the musical traditions, you know, that she's bringing to her performance of the song are themselves, you know, full of life, full of richness and full of diversity and variety. And, you know, finally, it means something for a Black woman, you know, to sing this song of song of oneself, you know, as Whitman might have put it, right? And to reclaim specifically every single part of her body, sexual and otherwise, you know, to say whatever you might have tried to take away, you couldn't take this, right? This reclamation of the Black female body as a source of sensual pride, you know, is very important and is very much a soul gesture. And finally, you know, when we think about this coming out in the late 1960s and how many Black people we have seen murdered and maimed, you know, and assaulted for trying to exercise and fight for civil rights, to say, "I have life," right, is actually a kind of, it's almost a taunt, you know, it's almost a statement of victory against those who would try to take that life away. So there's many different kinds of meanings that I see Nina Simone bringing to her cover of that song. And those meanings are musical and they're cultural and historical as well.
The way that you talk about soul music, I think, is really interesting because you don't always talk about the big picture. You don't talk about the big swoop of orchestration or the beauty of Aretha Franklin's piano playing and the way that she approaches her arrangements and things like that. You often will focus on very small moments in the music. So you have a chapter, for instance, about when singers go up into falsetto, or you talk about just small moments of ad-libbing. So what does giving your analysis over to so many of these very tiny moments in the music, how is that helpful for you in the way that you see soul music?
Yeah, thank you for that question. That's something that's so important to my approach to soul, is exactly that, to kind of really listen in detail, as Alexandra Vasquez puts it in her masterful study of Cuban music, which is called Listening in Detail. That's what I'm trying to do, is I'm trying to listen in detail. And that is sort of working against a couple of different impulses. You know, one is to focus, as you said, on the lyrical content of songs. And that's how soul has often been read, as simply a vehicle of Black power and Black civil rights messaging, right? So, you know, you can see that in the discussion of Sam Cooke's A Change Is Gonna Come, for instance. Nina Simone's Young, Gifted in Black, James Brown's Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. I mean, those songs are obviously important message songs, and they're beautiful songs, and they were very important to people in the movement and beyond. But if we think about soul as only being about those kind of lyrical message songs or protest songs, then we're going to miss a lot of other, what I would consider to be, you know, just as resonant soul moments that are happening more at the level of of form and more at the level of performance. So that whether or not a song is explicitly about, say, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, even if it's I've got to use my imagination, you know, even if it's I've got life, it's still sort of doing very important sociocultural and musical work. So that was one thing that I wanted to point out. You know, another thing about listening to the details is it works against, you know, again, you know, thinking here about there's something that the poet and critic Nathaniel Mackey writes about African-American literature. And he's saying, you know, he says, there's too often a tendency to read works by Black writers for what they can tell us about the quote unquote Black experience, whereas one reads works by white writers for things like formal innovation, you know, poetic expression, and these more kinds of artistic concerns. And so in working against the tradition of reading or privileging the message song, I'm thinking of that. And I'm thinking of how much more credit might we give these artists as artists if we think about what they're doing to beneath the level of, you know, what is the message that they are kind of promulgating and promoting. And then finally, the reason for focusing on the detail is to try to kind of, as I put it in the introduction, to kind of draw soul a little bit closer, right? Because soul has often been seen as this kind of mystical or distant or vague and nebulous kind of concept, right? Like, what even is it? And this was a question for people in the soul era, and it's a question today. But I think if we think about things like James Brown's grunts and, you know, Minnie Riperton's move into the falsetto, and the way that Nina Simone manages this incredible moment in the life performance that I mentioned, you know, where she thinks her microphone is off and she starts singing, the mic is off, the mic is off. And then it turns out that it's on. And so, you know, she kind of recovers from that moment and you know, uses it to create a call and response with the audience. In so doing, you know, shows us, you know, what that kind of, what it means to turn deprivation into, you know, a realization of actual abundance, right? In according to the soul logic that I'm describing. If we look at moments like that, you know, these little details, I think that we can see a lot more about what, more of what made soul so special. And we can, again, start to almost personalize a concept that has long been rendered rather impersonal, distant, and even problematic.
I really appreciated what you're saying about treating these musicians as artists, because so often they are not, or they are not treated as whole artists. Aretha Franklin is a great example of that, where she's just a singer, but actually she does so much more, right, than sing, as you pointed out in one of in your discussion earlier in the podcast. But there is always a tension, I think, for people who are studying music, really all kinds of music, between the artistic value of the music and the musicians and composers and producers and so forth as artists, but also understanding this music is a commercial enterprise and that there are commercial interests as well. That tension can be very difficult to navigate and to account for both sides of that in soul or in any other kind of music. Can you talk a little bit about how you dealt with that tension between the artistic side of soul and the fact that it still is a commercial type of music?
Sure. I think that that has been a problem that has plagued soul studies, as you know, as it has perhaps plagued other forms, you know, and it's a longstanding issue, as you say, you know, can a blues artist be quote unquote authentic if they're actually concerned with making money? You know, do they really have to be like sitting on a front porch somewhere in the deep South, like just strumming on an old guitar as the myth of the, you know, Southern Delta blues man might have it. But, you know, as people like actually my colleague Houston Baker have pointed out, you know, that there's really no contradiction between like being a blues singer and wanting to make money from, you know, honing this craft. And in fact, in some cases, it was precisely the concept of authenticity that people were using and trading in in order to market themselves, you know, in order to make more money. In other words, saying like, I'm the real deal, like I am so authentic. And in, you know, so styling themselves, you know, the idea was that they were the ones who should be whose records you should buy, you know, and who should, you know, get the gig and get the money. And so that, you know, I think my soul artists are kind of dealing with a similar kind of set of expectations as well. And they're navigating them in similar ways. So, you know, I think that soul has in some ways been framed as this kind of anti-commercial space, you know, that it's sort of all about this. There's a critic, Paul Gilroy, who explicitly says, you know, it's about the sort of anti-capitalist thrust. You know, he talks about the anti-capitalist thrust of the music. And I think that in some ways might be there, you know, on a kind of philosophical level, you know, striving for something better that really has nothing to do with your place within the kind of American capitalist system. But I mean, in musical terms, in actual material musical terms, people did want to get paid. You know, they wanted to be noticed. They wanted to be famous. They wanted to get rich. And that, I think, was not really a problem for the artists themselves, you know. I think that my Black artists, you know, the Black artists in the study would be accused of selling out if they, you know, hired too many white people, you know, to kind of manage their careers, or if it seemed like they were selling out in terms of the music that they started to record. They're playing, you know, kind of segregated venues. You know, if they were making certain, you know, decisions with their careers that seemed not to support Black people, then I think they could be sort of accused of selling out. But just the fact of making money was not something that people were generally upset about. So, for example, you know, when you see these artists being covered in the Black press, people are excited to list like all the cars that James Brown has, you know, how big his house is, and, you know, all the whatever, the fur coat that people have, Isaac Hayes in his fur-lined, you know, Cadillac. Like, this is actually good in part because there's an expectation that Black artists are going to funnel the money that they make back into their communities, and that they're going to hire Black managers and Black promoters, and, you know, that they're going to kind of do things quote unquote for the people, which in fact they did, you know. And a lot of my artists were like very conscious about being social activists. Isaac Hayes is a good example of that. Aretha Franklin and the work that she did, you know, for Martin Luther King and other figures is a good example of that. Donny Hathaway is another good example of that. Nina Simone, you know, who recorded, you know, some songs that SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, took as anthems of their organization. It's a great example of that. So there really wasn't a contradiction for them, I don't think, between being great artists, being recognized and compensated accordingly for their artistry and their labor, and being political activists.
So I could talk about this all day long, but I feel like we need to start wrapping up. And I feel like it would be remiss not to at least have one question that talks about Black Lives Matter, because you do end the book by talking about more recent artists. And since you finished the book, of course, this civil rights activism of Black Lives Matter has only just become more and more visible. We certainly have had a summer and fall of, in some cities, daily protests because of, in support of Black Lives Matter, and also some very serious violent repercussions as well. That does remind me quite a bit of some of the same kinds of cultural, social, and political tensions that were happening in the late 60s and early 70s when Soul was born. So what do you see as the soul logic of Black Lives Matter and the age in which we live today?
Well, I think that Black Lives Matter sort of shows that the political energies associated with Soul never actually died. They might have been suppressed in post-revolutionary backlash, you know, kinds of moments that produced the neoliberal situation that I was describing earlier, this kind of each one for himself, you know, the real dismantling of public programs, and, you know, the dismantling of the welfare state, that that all of these things do work to try to suppress the energy and the revolutionary possibility that Seoul sounded and Seoul represented, but that those things never actually go away. You know, I think about something that Angela Davis says, which is, you know, freedom is a constant struggle. And it's not like you just achieve it, right? And then it's, you're done. It's not like civil rights movement. I mean, and this is, again, a way that I think the book tries to refute some popular discourse, or, you know, the way that, that civil rights and Black power themselves have been memorialized in the national imaginary as these moments where, particularly with civil rights, you know, Martin Luther King had a dream. That dream was realized through legislation such as the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, and now everything is fine. And anybody who complains about things not being okay is actually just part of the problem, because they are failing to properly get over, right? You know, this historical trauma that is now sort of over and done with, right? That is a story that people tell, that is very convenient for some. But, you know, these things are not kind of over and done with. You know, they stay with us, that there's work that does need to be done, and that constant struggle continues. And so I think that in that way, Seoul itself, and that the logic of collective striving and the need to believe that there is something better on the other side, not only for you, but for people like you, that continues. And I think that, you know, that's what we're seeing in the resurgence of the Black Lives Matter movement now.
Well, as we, I wish we could keep talking about this, but I hope that this interview gives people an idea of what your book is about and the various issues that you explore in it. And before we go, I'd love to know, what are you working on now?
Well, thank you for asking. One thing that I'm working on is actually an editorial project. I am co-editor with Joshua Clover, who's a professor and music critic at UC Davis, but we've begun a series of books called the Single Series. It's a little bit like the 33 and a Third series, which is, you know, these short books on particular albums, except that our series, a single series, as its name suggests, is a series of books, each of which is devoted to one particular single. So one particular song that has, you know, resonance across time. And we have books forthcoming on Jimi Hendrix's Voodoo Child, as well as actually on Beyoncé's Formation. We have a book somebody's writing about Old Town Road. And so I'm excited just to kind of usher some of those works into the world. For myself, I've been working a little bit more in journalism recently, and working on some profiles of artists and doing some interviews with them. And one reason why I mentioned that, although I can't say too much about those projects at the moment, I mention it because I think that the interview is such a useful, vital art form, actually, in that, you know, the questions that you ask, I'm sure you know this as an interviewer yourself, the questions that you ask somebody make all the difference in terms of the narrative that you're able to sort of draw out from them and construct around them. And something that I said in my first book, Black Resonance, you know, which was looking at these classic women singers, I mentioned, you know, Bessie Smith, Billie Holiday, and so on. There was a moment in the book where I said, you know, we know very little about their processes, these women's processes of training and development and honing their skills across time, in part because people didn't ask them about that. You know, they asked them about a lot of other things, you know, Billie Holiday's drug use and, you know, who is she dating, right? But the press has very, very rarely been interested in the details of, you know, these women's artistic lives. And I think that we still see that, you know, in some music writing today, you know, in which the story of, you know, what was your childhood like, or what happened with that guy you were dating, often overshadows the question of, like, what were you thinking when you made this album, right? And so those are the questions that I've been wanting to ask artists for years, and am getting to do in some of my recent work. So that's what I'm up to currently.
Well, that actually is very exciting, because I do think that music journalism can be quite wonderful, but often it is very sexist, very reductive, very frustrating. And I'm excited to hear that you are going to be out there trying to correct some of those problems. So that's really great to hear. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm Kristen Turner. This is New Books in Music, a channel on the New Books Network. And I've been talking to Emily J. Lordy, author of The Meaning of Soul, Black Music and Resilience Since the 1960s.